Thank you for joining us on the Voices of Homelessness podcast. I'm Donald Whitehead. I'm your host. We at the National Coalition for the Homeless present the Voices of Homelessness to make sure that the general public has a true understanding of who experiences homelessness in this country. We are often presented with stereotypes, misinformation, and dishonesty about the true nature of homelessness. We hope to address and negate some of that misinformation through this show. We broadcast once a month, and we certainly thank you. We're bringing people who really have lived experience of housing instability or homelessness, and people who are working hard to make sure that you know the true nature of homelessness. The National Coalition is the oldest and largest advocacy organization that is led by people with lived experience. So we thank you for joining us, and we'll get started right away. We have two amazing guests tonight. You probably recognize one of our guests. She is actually the producer of the show, but she has a story to tell as well. Coletta Harris is an amazing filmmaker, producer, and really just an amazing person who I've gotten to know and who will tell you a little bit about what she's gotten to know as she does this work. And then we have Alan Mack. Alan is kind of a new voice in advocacy with the National Coalition, but he's been doing a lot of work in his own community. He's from Boston. Or lives in Boston right now. I'll have him tell us the rest of that story. But we welcome both of you to Voices of Homelessness, and we thank you for having the courage and willingness to share a bit of your story with those that are watching across the country. So, Alan, I think we're going to start with you. Just tell us a little bit about your story. Tell us how you were introduced to the issue of homelessness, and what you're doing today.
First, I'd like to say thank you for allowing me to be a guest. It's an honor and a pleasure to speak on this podcast, as well as just being a part of the Speakers Bureau for the National Coalition for the Homeless. I've started my homelessness advocacy and really understanding what homelessness was after being homeless. It wasn't something that I understood while actually experiencing homelessness, while going through evictions, before even my injury, having to stay with family, having to house hop, all these different things that were, in a sense, normalized to me. And then after actually experiencing my injury in around 2020 in April, I was shot. And at this time, I was actually living in my car, so I was experiencing real housing instability and not knowing what the next step or what the next day would be. And it just so happened that it was the wrong place and the wrong time. I ended up getting shot in my spine, and I lived, or rather had to be an inpatient at Spalding for 30 days. Following that during COVID, which I can say is probably one of the best institutions for spinal cord injury rehabilitation. But experiencing homelessness going into Spalding, and then after actually being discharged, not having a real plan, not having a space of my own, I ended up having to go through living with family. And the one thing I can say about homelessness and how it looks different in so many different eyes and perspectives is it can happen to anybody, as well as the shift in what it feels like for other people. I was disabled going through homelessness, and this was something that was new to my family with the disability. So there was an uncomfortable space with being in certain places with different people, different family members. So I spent around 6 months just going from family member to family member and not really having a place to give me stability and to give me that peace of mind to kind of really really actually recover and become what I learned to be, was realize my self potential. And it was just amazing. I had happened to get in contact with an organization from Boston called the Home for Little Wanderers. And I can say with high praise that they are one of the best direct service care providers in housing that I've ever seen in my lifetime. They've provided me with a permanent supportive housing voucher, and I duly tell everybody that that is the reason why I'm at where I'm at today. Those wraparound services that come with permanent supportive housing and that housing first model is what allowed me to go from someone that was said to be homeless to being an author, a poet, a student at two different colleges, speaker at Tufts, at Loyola, all of these different things that have come out of what someone would think was homelessness. So housing instability to me is something that it varies from person to person, but it's looked at and stigmatized. So I hate to say the word wrong, but it's the only way I can kind of describe it. And I've seen people just walk past people that are experiencing homelessness and not look at them as if they're actual people. And I could only think, what if that was me? I experienced homelessness different than that person, but what if that organization that just happened to see my situation or didn't see that in other people? And that's the reason why I do what I do now, because it's a miracle and a blessing to, one, go through something and to be able to give back in a way that is meaningful and impactful.
Thank you. Really heartwarming and profound and also really inspiring at the same time. So we'll come back to you in a few minutes just to talk about, you know, what that work looks like today.
We're being harassed. We can't be in the parks. You know, we can't be at the bus transit stations. Law enforcement, they're subject to pull up on us and tell us, you know, hey, you can't sit here, you can't stand there, you have to move on.
They took up all the benches in town so that nobody could sit down anywhere.
I done went to jail down here in Raleigh, North Carolina, 4 times since I've been down here.
I don't think it should be a crime for being homeless.
It's more like out of sight, out of mind.
How do you criminalize somebody's situation?
They're called ordinances, but they're usually city laws that make it a crime to sleep in public, to sit in public, to lie down in public, to sleep in a car, to beg for help, to eat sometimes in public. I mean, they just take a variety of different forms.
They was talking about rounding homeless people up and put them in something like a concentration camp.
Our literature says 3.5 million people. If people knew the true number of homeless people, if we documented that true number of homeless people, we don't have the resources to address the problem. And that is a statement directly from an elected official.
Since 1995, the Department of Housing and Urban Development has not given us any money to build housing.
Gentrification is the only housing policy that this city has. Atlanta's housing policy is gentrification. That's it.
I want to do more for myself and getting myself out of this homelessness so I can pay for me a home.
But when you have no address, getting just a decent, regular, scheduled job, virtually impossible.
Colita, we wanted to talk to you. I hope I said it right, because, you know, just as an apology, we've known each other for several years now, and sometimes I get it right and sometimes I get it wrong. So please tell the audience how you'd like to pronounce it. But your story is a unique story because, you know, we met through another longtime advocate. And at the time you were making a documentary, and I didn't know your story, but I could see through the documentary your passion and the idea also that you went right to where people congregate. You talk to a lot of different people. Tell us about a little bit about your story, but also what the effects of making No Address, the documentary, how did that change you? How did it make you feel? And it may not have changed you, but just give us a little tidbit or a few of those on what this meant to you as you created this powerful documentary and the work you do in South Carolina.
Thank you so much for having me, Donald. And my name is Kalita. I've heard it all, so I won't get offended, but it is Kalita Harris. And yeah, ironically, it's crazy that I've never experienced homelessness until I started doing the documentary, right? So in Atlanta, the first series is Columbia, South Carolina. It's a two-part series, and the other one is Atlanta, Georgia. So I moved to Atlanta thinking I was going to get into the industry, but universe had something different for me. I was just supposed to do the documentary. So one of my friends was like, well, just come on and move with me. This you want to do, come to the area. I moved here. I'm in the film industry, da da da. So I stayed with her for about 6 months or so until I could just maintain and get on my feet, because I kind of just started all over, because being an entrepreneur, you know, you rely on your clients. But I was so passionate on doing the second part to see what else was going on around the country. And then that's when I actually moved. So that's kind of like my story by definition, to say my name wasn't on a lease. I didn't have an address. Yes, I did experience it. But to start the journey, it's like I'm an empath. So I would communicate with everybody. I just wasn't a judgmental person. Like, you treat me well, I treat you well. So just being downtown, my office during that time in 2013, I would always communicate with the unsheltered, and we'd just talk to each other, just like my friends and family. So then it was like one day I was in my office. I read in the newspaper that Columbia City Council wanted to do something about their homeless issue, and they had three options, and one option was jail. And I was like, what? I'm appalled by that. Like, sending somebody to jail? What if that were me and I had to go to jail for a place where I am a native and I have nowhere to go? So I wanted to know what was going on. How did people feel? I already had a production company. I already had the tools. So I said, let me start documenting what's going on around me. And my very first interview, I told a colleague of mine, I need to interview someone. I want to do this documentary. So my very first interview was in the park, and it was one of my former classmates. And he did not recognize me because he was a couple of years older than me. But we were in a drama class, and I knew he was going to be something amazing, like an actor or a comedian or something. He was just that talented. So when I saw him in the park, I didn't say anything. We went through the interview, and he was so articulate on how law enforcement was treating the unsheltered and what real solutions need to be implemented. And then we talked at the end, and I introduced myself and told him who I was. And he was like, oh, my gosh, you know. And then he further went into his story, and it was just so sad just to see my people, you know, going through this. And what I wanted to do was really break down the stereotypes that you cannot identify who is unsheltered and who isn't just by looking at them. So I broke down those stereotypes. And then at that point, it just turned into a full feature. Like, everyone was connecting me with everyone. And that was the whole premise behind Columbia, was that it was unanimously voted to criminalize homelessness. But the outrage of the community and the people, they ended up rescinding the vote a month later. So the power of the people, it was a great story. And then I ended up traveling to Raleigh, Skid Row, Orlando, so many places. And then, so the first part was just getting to know the human beings, right? And their stories and the history of how we got here. And then part two is delving into the system to say, this is not their fault. It is all systematic, it's all by design. And that's why we are still here 100 years later. So there are solutions, and I presented a lot of solutions, and now I want to be a part of the solution. So I created the No Address Foundation, where we are obtaining land to build affordable, obtainable, like shipping container style homes for the unsheltered. So we're moving and grooving on this, and I want to take this model across the country. So that's kind of just how it sparked for me.
Well, thank you so much. And you do it really well. I was really, we actually screened your documentary at George Washington University, and it was absolutely well received. And I know that it has had some commercial success, and you actually received an Emmy for the work, as a matter of fact, right?
No, the Emmy was for another work, but we did receive awards at the Film Festival Best Documentaries. And you can watch the documentary on Tubi, Prime, YouTube, other various platforms, and my website at noaddressdocumentary.com.
And not to be confused with another No Address that we don't think as favorable to the real story that we're hearing today. I wanted to kind of talk a little bit about like where we are when it comes to homeless services, the criminalization of homelessness, and some of the cutbacks in federal funding. Alan mentioned permanent supportive housing and how effective that was for him. We have a HUD secretary right now that thinks that we should move away from that kind of housing. Even though the facts say that this is proven 80% successful in the places where it's been researched, they want to move to something that's a more of a transitional period of housing, or actual transitional housing. We know that one of the failures of that strategy is that they'll still need permanent housing after that transition is done. They also are addressing. Alan, you talked about your injury, and I believe you're in a chair at this point. One of the things that this administration is challenging is the Olmstead Act, which provides resources, provides equity, make sure that people aren't put into institutions involuntarily. Getting to Kalita's information about the criminalization. You know that there was a Supreme Court decision last year, and now 360 plus cities now have laws, the worst of which is in Louisiana, where now they can sentence you not only to prison, but to hard labor. And it really harkens back to the Jim Crow post-Reconstruction era of this country. And just wanted to hear what the two of you think about kind of this direction. And based on your experience, what do you think the outcomes may be? And both of you can answer that question.
And I constantly speak on things like this. I find it to be one of the most drastic choices for HUD to kind of make this transition from a data-proven model that houses people, and not only houses them, but keeps them housed, as well as giving them the services that they need to not only be housed, but also be productive parts of society. And so to transition away from this to something that is more transitional and doesn't give the person the well-needed benefits of being housed and staying housed is it's appalling to me, and it's the reason why I go.
How long have you been in your permanent supportive housing?
6 years now.
6 years. And if it would have been only 2 years, what would that have looked like for you? If someone came to you 2 years in and said, hey, that's all the time you have, you need to look for something else.
it would look like homelessness again. And that's what a lot of the advocacy I do on Boston's Advisory Council for Ending Homelessness is about, is advising the city on policy and what would be the best solutions for things of this sort, because to possibly have budget cuts that could affect over 1,800 households of people that have permanent supportive housing, what does a solution look like that? And the fact that we're in a position where we have to actually devise strategies for and anticipate that as a hypothetical situation is, it's honestly downright disturbing. Just to think that that many people will just can become unhoused at the blink of an eye if these type of changes are made.
Yeah, and that's just some of the changes, because there's also bigger changes that, and I only say bigger because it affects more people. So, you know, this administration is talking about cutting back on subsidized housing, public housing, and the housing choice voucher or Section 8 program to make the limits for those 2 years. Kalita, what do you think would be the impact that might have? Think about subsidized housing in Atlanta or South Carolina, but Atlanta, because that's kind of where public housing started. Just think about if you take those units, those big units in Atlanta, and you give people 2 year time limits. What kind of community would Atlanta look like after that?
Well, they're creating homelessness, if you will. There's no prevention in this process, because if that's what you're going to do, you are expecting an influx of people to be on the streets to the amount that's already there. And my question is why? Why? Because even if a person lost their home just because they couldn't afford it and then go into these programs and they happen to get a voucher without having to be like chronically homeless or anything else, they get a voucher, but they only have 2 years. That's still not helping them, right? So that's not helping a person that's been chronic either. So what are we doing? Are we just forcing people back on the street so you can criminalize them? That's the only thing that makes sense to me. We know there's profit for prisons.
Right.
You know, and free labor. So this is what you want to do, or you want to round them up and put them in some type of internment camp and do something devastating to the people. So I don't know, but the agenda, it doesn't make sense of why they're doing this, because whatever was working now.
It's not even cost effective. It actually costs more to have someone enter the criminal justice system. It also costs more for emergency room visits and mental health services if you make people homeless.
It costs taxpayers $30,000 to $50,000 per year per person to keep them jailed. And on top of that, you have to have at least 95% of the jails occupied, or they will lose their funding.
There's also changes to immigration status. I don't know if that affects either of you, but that's another potentially 3 million people that would lose their housing. I do think one thing you said is probably what the answer is. I mean, the group that is promoting the idea of criminalization is called the Cicero Institute. Yep. And their founders actually are very connected to private prisons and data surveillance. And so it appears to be a way for them to get more resources. So they're profiting off of these ideas that are being generated. In Atlanta, you know, this summer, a person was killed, was picked up and crushed on the streets of Atlanta while they were doing this.
Cornelius.
Say that again?
Cornelius.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that has happened in D.C. It's happened in other parts of the country. I think the idea is to hide people versus get rid of the issue of homelessness. Because this is a total opposite direction that you would have if it, truly your goal at the end of the day was to end homelessness. You know, we know that the population has a lot of people with disabilities. You actually have to have a disability, by the way, listeners, to qualify for permanent supportive housing. So this is a project the housing first, permanent supportive housing model that really addresses people that have the greatest barriers once they become homeless. And, you know, if those resources aren't available, not only will we see more people be homeless, we'll see more people die, unfortunately. We hear stories when they do the sweeps of encampments of, you know, things like your wheelchair, Alan, being scooped up and dumped into a dumpster, or people's CPAP machines, or other devices people use just to stay alive. I think people would be, should be amazed that that's happening in this country. While you were in the emergency situation, Alan, did you see that kind of stuff happening in Boston, which Boston is kind of a bastion of progressive thinking, but it's not always progressive when it comes to homelessness, right?
I can agree there. There is a lot of people that are progressive thinking on homelessness, but there is, I can faithfully say, an ideological thinking when it comes to the police force. And that's part of the reason why a lot of organizations have done a lot of grassroots organizing with police departments, simply because of the stigma and the idea that comes with homelessness and how they view people that are homeless. So I haven't specifically seen those situations, but I have heard from numerous different people of these types of situations of losing wheelchairs, losing assistive devices, losing, like you said, CPAP machines, things and medical devices that are not only needed to survive, but needed to thrive in life if they had the opportunity to. So a lot of what I think is a real solution to this is breaking that stigma and allowing people to understand that homelessness is not something that you cannot, like Kalita said, identify from just view. I like to really think of it as really put it in perspective as if it may be somebody from your family, and then deal with it as appropriate as you feel, because I don't think a lot of people view it that way. If that was your aunt, if that was your uncle, if that was your mother, sister, brother, in that situation, would you deal with them to the same effect? And I don't believe so. And so I think that's really a true solution, or one of the true solutions is at least breaking that stigma on housing and homelessness.
Absolutely. And the other underarching idea, and it's a thread for both of you, I think, and I may be assuming here, the idea now with service delivery, at least in the homeless sector, is everybody needs substance abuse treatment. So, Coletta, could you tell us a little bit about, did you have any need for substance abuse treatment when you were having your housing stability? And Alan, I'd love for you to answer that also. There is, and all those people you met, because there is a higher incidence of substance abuse when people are unsheltered. Sometimes they're using substances because they're unsheltered. So tell us about you. You would have had to, you know, if you needed to go through the system, regardless of where you are, you would have had to go through a substance abuse program based on what is being promoted by this Department of Housing and Urban Development. Would that have worked for you?
No. And my thing is, why are you doing that? See, these are my questions. It doesn't make sense. These intake processes, if you know this person does not have an issue, why do they have to go through the same steps as everybody else?
They believe people need to be fixed.
Right. There's no one size fits all when it comes to anybody's issues.
Right.
So why are we categorizing unshelteredness? You know what I mean? A lot of it's just you don't have a home, right? Or a lot of it's abuse or something or whatever. It can a natural disaster, medical bill. Anything in this economy right now can put you on the streets if you don't have support. So I just don't understand why they're doing that. And then we got to stop categorizing it and stereotyping people, because see, it's so easy to do that and then brush people off to say, oh, they have that, so they just need some help. And that's not our issue. That's not our problem. But when you realize that, oh, it's somebody in your family or somebody else, and you know they don't have these issues, then you want to be an advocate for them. But we need to start looking at individuals as individuals and help them where they are. Because I always believe, and I know, if I were on the streets, I probably would result to that. If I were on the streets, I would become mental. But it's not that they're mental prior to. It's because of, you know, and these are the only options that they have, you know. So if there are no shelter beds, you're going to go to jail because the grants passed. Before, you didn't. But now if their shelters are full, you still going to jail if you're getting caught on the streets. So we have to fix this and we have to bring awareness. Like Alan said, it's all about awareness and breaking down these stereotypes first.
And what we can do. It's amazing that in some places, not just going to jail, it's going to jail with a felony. So right. Tennessee, it's up to 6 years in jail. There's several other places across the country where it's a felony. It's gotten so bad that there was one community that wanted to find people who were helping people that are homeless. So let me ask you something from your creative vision. If you were doing a story about someone's life as a homeless person, what would that story be like?
It would just start from the beginning. I want to hear your whole story, right? That's where I want to go. And how do we get to this point? And a lot of times it's not the person's fault. Sometimes it is person's fault and they own up to it. You know what I mean? But how do we do better? How can we have things in place where people can transition? I feel like we're just band-aiding everything or making new statutes for people to continually stay in this cycle. So we need real human beings, real souls to come together and collaborate to make this work. And stories are everything at this point. Storytelling, social media, this is the way we're going to get this message out. But we have to be consistent and have all of us share it as well.
I completely agree. That was actually one of the reasons why I did one of my own documentaries with a high school friend. She now does photography for New Balance, but it's exactly what you said. In creating the documentary, it was something that I didn't want to just start at me getting shot. I wanted people to know my full story and how I got to the point of being shot, how other systemic, governmental relationships were influential in me being homeless and me having social determinants of health, not being, having the correct amount of financial support, being impoverished at some certain times in life, all these different things that contribute to homelessness. And just as you were saying, I had never directly abused drugs or alcohol until I was actually experiencing homelessness and my disability together. And it was the first 6 months of directly after being shot and not having an understanding or not really having those wraparound services from what's permanent supportive housing. And it wasn't until I did get that certain care management and help with just emotional support and actual understanding of what substance abuse was that I actually stopped doing that. And it was the help that I received that got me to that point. It wasn't prior to, I wasn't doing any of that before being homeless, before being disabled, and just having that support system and not just being a substance abuse program, but having someone to actually speak to was really the biggest thing. And like you said, stories are what I've come to believe and understand from the people I speak to is what impacts people the most, is hearing someone's full story and how they've gotten to the point in life where they are is what impacts a person to want to make a change.
Well, that's amazing. And I love that you talk about, you bust another myth when you talk about your experience with permanent housing, because you talk a lot about the support you received. Some try to make it out to be a program that's just housing, and it doesn't offer you other services to be able to transition your life. And we know that from your story. We know it to not be true, but we also hear it very clearly in your story that you didn't just have a roof over your head. You had a lot of support to go along with that.
Yeah, that support was essential. I received support and job training. They helped me get into a course at Benjamin Franklin Institute of Technology for professionalism and just an introduction into emailing and just professional communication. That is what sprouted me to go back into learning. I've always loved music. I've always been someone that's been in tune with just older music, new music, and just loving sound waves. And they noticed that. They could tell that. And my case manager was the one that pushed me and said, "You love music. Why don't you go back to school for music?" And I was someone that was, I went to John D. O'Brien School of Mathematics. It was one of the three exam schools in Boston, but I was a bit of a knucklehead during high school. So I kind of told her that I can't see myself going back to college. If I did, I would want to go to the best music school, and that's Berkeley. So there's no way I'm getting in there. And she said, "How could you know if you don't try?" And she pushed me to actually apply. And little did I know, I received that acceptance letter, and I think I cried for 2 days straight, because never would I have imagined this kid that grew up in housing projects, that's been evicted, that's been, I can say, at least 9 or different apartments growing up, single mother. My father died when I was 3 years old. To go from all of the obstacles that I've gone through to now being accepted into the number one most prestigious school for music in the world for a music production bachelor was, I mean, exhilarating is an understatement. And that's only because I had the support system of permanent supportive housing. With that came so many different opportunities that I've been introduced to just from that organization that provides my voucher. They've allowed me to have speaking engagements. They've connected me with different organizations that do advocacy in the city of Boston and around the state, like Massachusetts Housing and Shelter Alliance, United Way.
Hosses. I always love that name. That's what I
mean. Joyce Tavon, the CEO, is a wonderful person. I've done at least 2 or 3 speaking engagements with her. And I can say that she is one of the leading forces in the state on really making a change and advocating for policy that is going to actually make an end homelessness and have a solution to that problem. So, I mean, it all stems back to really having that actual wraparound services that come with not just being housed, but to help me stay housed.
That's amazing. And I think, like, one of my approaches when I operated shelters was exactly what you just said. Like, often people who operate programs, they kind of work on the deficits, right? They work on the things that they see in you that might not be positive or may need help with, where you may need help. But my idea was always to focus on people's assets. And it sounds like somebody did some really good motivational interviewing and listening, and they learned about your desires with music, and they built that into a program, and now look where it's gotten you. I do see a collaboration between the two of you in the future, but I wanted to go back to you, Mrs. Harris. I want to just talk a little bit about kind of as you've gone through this many, many interviews. I think that there were dozens of interviews. What else can we do to address those really deep-rooted stereotypes that seem to have gotten hold? And how can we get elected officials to really understand the need to stay with evidence-based practices? We didn't need dramatic change. We need, as you said earlier, a lot more structural attention to the bigger picture issues, like the lack of affordable housing, the need for mental health care and care for people leaving the criminal justice system, and more emphasis on people with disabilities. So I know I said a lot there, but wanted to hear your thoughts on those things.
Okay, so I would say to the average person, don't be afraid. Like, we're human beings, right? Like, don't be afraid of a person that just doesn't have a home or you see on the streets or in a shelter or whatever. I mean, if that's your thing, then just get out the way, right? But I say, listen, if you want to help, if you want to do something, listen to the people. Don't put your stuff on people and say what you think and what you believe that they should be doing or whatever with their life, right? Because you wouldn't want anybody telling you what they need to do with your life, right? So I say, listen to people, see where they are and see what you can find out. And the thing is with community, we need to get better at it. Like right now with the cooling centers, it is hot. This is death weather right now, you know, even for winter and summer, it is very hot. So we should be collaborating and have a community to know how to get the information out to people. Because I'm putting out on Facebook, like, where are the cooling centers in Atlanta, in South Carolina, da 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 da, and getting people to let me know and send maps or whatever. And then we spread that information. But if people don't know, you have people suffering right now in the heat or trying somewhere to stay cool, or they're getting kicked out wherever they are and say you only can be here for a few minutes and stuff like that. Like, this is where information needs to be key. And now we can start saving our people, right? That's the first thing. So with legislation, I want to be able to get into lobbying. We need to figure out how we can get in with all the other ones, make them feel and see that this is dire. So I want to be able to get in front of them, and hopefully we get the governor that we want here, because he's experienced homelessness in his lifetime. So he understands what we can do and start putting things on the books. And the biggest thing to get people housed, homeless, don't have a home, right? The biggest thing is to start working on these dilapidated buildings, right? We can renovate.
Adaptive reuse.
Rapid reuse, and put hundreds of people in homes until we really figure out how we can build real sustainable housing. We're building all over the country, but they're not affordable. Right.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's why that bill would have helped from these corporations buying up all of these homes and just letting them sit. But
hopefully
Trump did something different. So hopefully we can get this thing passed, because this is a bipartisan bill and people are on board. So this is a great start to having a solution. And then we can get all the organizations that focus on housing, give them what they need, because there's a lot of free land out here. Give us what we need so we can build. So I feel like though that's what needs to be on the books. And I know NCH is definitely working on policy with the rapid reuse. And we could just get this information on how we can help. Like, that's what it needs. It needs to get to the average person, because a lot of people do want to help. They just don't know. And then go to Alan's point. I know I'm trying to put a lot in right now. But to go to Alan's point, what we need really is safe spaces. Like these day centers that we have, we need to make these safe spaces, like with the healing frequencies, like you said, and things that people are interested in doing. That is therapy. That's therapeutic. You don't have to go through these extensive programs that really don't apply to you just to say you did it in order to, you know, check that off the list, and then you can go on to the next, you can go on to the next. Because a lot of people can't even get resources unless they've been unsheltered for a certain amount of time, which makes no sense to me. I thought the goal was to hurry up and get them transitioned into something so they wouldn't be chronic. I think safe spaces are really something that we can start healing the community first, and then having non-congregate shelters would really help so people can be to themselves and have a safe space for their belongings and everything else in their families, right? Until they can transition. So I think those are the things that we can implement quickly, and then we can focus on long-term solutions.
Thank you. Thank you. We need you to run for office.
To add on to what Khalida was saying about information sharing, that's one of the things that pushed me to become, in Massachusetts, what's called a certified community health worker. I ended up doing a training because of the Home Florida Wanderers at what's called Tufts Cohere Program. And then I became licensed as a community health worker. That is one of the positions that is fairly new across the country. But really, it's exactly what you're speaking of, Khalida. It's an information share of somebody that knows the resources, somebody that has the cultural appropriate knowledge to speak with the residents and the people in their community. And that's also currently the position that I just received and now being employed at Mass General Brigham. So it's really a full circle moment to now be at the same place where I started my recovery and to be in a position to be in the communities like Dorchester and Roxbury and just information share and connect and network with the people that are actually underserved and giving them the knowledge that they actually need to access these resources.
Awesome. Well, you know, we absolutely appreciate the both of you because, you know, another big issue that we have is like when people go through this experience, no matter how brief it is or however long, they want to get as far away as possible. They don't want to be reminded of the trauma. They don't want to be labeled. And so we lose a lot of people who would be really valuable assets to the community as advocates. And so I just salute the two of you for the work you're doing in the different ways that you're doing it. And we just need more people who use their spheres of influence, whether it's your community health work or it's your work in getting the arts involved in the work. I do believe that the key to resolving homelessness is to re-engage people with whatever beauty they had in their lives, whatever artistic avenues that they experienced, regardless of what it is. It may not even be what we consider artistic, but it's their way to use their brain power and creativity to do whatever it is. And we just don't do enough of that. We come up with these cookie cutter models, and they certainly don't resonate with everybody. We have to make homelessness an issue that politicians care about, either because they come from the population, like the governor that you mentioned, or they're just everyday people like ourselves. We have to, one, get people to vote. Only about 10% of the people who are homeless vote. That's like 70,000 people. What if it was 300,000 people or even 100,000 people? People would then have enough fear of this population that they couldn't just ignore the issues. And so we got to get involved in all phases of the world. I do thank both of you. I really appreciate what you've brought to the discussion and what you've presented to the general public, a true face of homelessness. It's such a diverse group of people and amazing people. And I thank you for sharing your amazing gifts with us tonight on The Voices of Homelessness. We thank you for listening. We thank you for being interested in the voices and the experience and the move away from stereotypes about this issue. We hope that you'll continue to watch this program. We do our best to unpack the realities of homelessness, to talk about the solutions. And we thank the National Coalition for the Homeless for hosting us. We thank Khalida Harris for her amazing work as the producer. And again, we thank Alan Mack for joining us. And we thank all of you. And please continue to watch The Voices of Homelessness so you know the true story. You know what really are the issues and the solutions for homelessness. We thank you very much. Have a good day.